This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM, and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support. So let's rejoin our hosts, Bill McLaughlin and Joseph Horowitz, as they further explore the American orchestra concert experience and history. This discussion was sparked by this comment by Maestro Riccardo Muti.
And that was in the 50s. The level of the orchestras in the world since then, especially in the 70s, 80s, has gone up everywhere in the world.
Hey there, welcome back. It's Bill McLaughlin here with Joe Horowitz. Joe, you were provoked into making this program, this little adventure we're embarked upon, by hearing a remark from Riccardo Muti, in which Maestro explained that orchestras are way better nowadays than they used to be. And you take exception. In the first hour, we were listening to recordings, wonderful old recordings from Stokowski with Philadelphia Orchestra and Koussevitzky with Boston. Who do we have on now in this half of the program?
Well, we'll begin, of course, with Toscanini. The three iconic great conductors from the interwar decades here in the United States were Koussevitzky in Boston and Stokowski in Philadelphia. Toscanini, first with the Metropolitan Opera, then with the New York Philharmonic, then with the NBC Symphony, is different. He was never the music director of the New York Philharmonic. He never conducted more than 15 weeks a season. But he created an instrument while he was there that was unique. And we can hear it on record. We're going to listen to the first act prelude from La Traviata as recorded in 1929. So this is the year before he famously took the New York Philharmonic on tour to Europe. I'd just like to mention, looking at my book, Classical Music in America, A History, that in Berlin the audience included Bruno Walter, Otto Klemperer, Eric Kleiber, and George Sell. And Sell later said that he had experienced Toscanini shock. This is what Sell wrote. This was orchestral performance of a kind new to all of us. The clarity of texture, the precision of ensemble, the rightness of balances, the virtuosity of every section, every solo player of the orchestra, then at its peak, so you see he agrees with me and not with Riccardo Muti, in the service of an interpretative concept of evident self-effacing integrity enforced with irresistible willpower and unflagging ardor, set new, undreamt of standards literally overnight. And I add, never before had American classical music so set standards for the world. Significantly, the vehicle was not a composer, but an orchestra under a foreign conductor, which is to say, we never acquired a native canon like those other classical music traditions in places like Russia and Italy and Germany. Hmm. Our classical music culture, for better or worse, probably for worse, has always been focused on the celebrity performer or the great orchestra. So here is a great orchestra, the New York Philharmonic, conducted by Toscanini in 1929.
Prelude to the first act of La Traviata of Verdi.
Thank you.
Lovely playing.
So, was it perfect?
It was human. I like human better than perfect, Joe. Music of the great composer Giuseppe Verdi, to whom Toscanini felt very, very close. This is the prelude to Act One of La Traviata, recorded with the New York Philharmonic in 1929.
I asked that question because that was one of the things that was most admired in Toscanini's performances, mm-hmm. something we didn't hear in Koussevitzky's performances, perfection.
Mm-hmm.
Perfection of intonation, perfection of ensemble, perfection of
balance. Maybe it's because of my early theological training. I prefer the word excellence to perfection. I don't think perfection is humanly achievable. And I get a little crazy when I hear people talk about perfection. I think what they're meaning is it sounds really, really good.
Well, I agree with you. My question was a loaded one.
Mm-hmm.
As I remarked about an hour ago, orchestras may indeed play more perfectly today, but that doesn't mean that they're better.
Mm.
And we'll now come to a conductor who was certainly not about perfection. He doesn't make it on every list of the great conductors, but he should. And I'm talking about Dmitri Mitropoulos. And I'm not talking about Mitropoulos conducting the New York Philharmonic. I'm talking about Mitropoulos conducting the Minneapolis Symphony, which he did from 1937 to 1949. I write in my book that the two orchestras in this period with the most distinctive sonic imprint are Philadelphia under Stokowski and Mitropoulos and Minneapolis, which could not possibly be more different from Stokowski. I think of Mitropoulos in the context of the cabinet of Dr. Caligari,
like a demonic. That's an expressionist film.
He's an expressionist conductor. Huh. His aesthetic base is the music of Schoenberg and Berg and Webern. He brings it to everything he touches, for better or worse. This is an orchestra unlike any other. The concertmaster is Louis Krasner. Did you know Louis Krasner?
Very famous soloist. He was the. Did he play the Berg Concerto Premiere?
And the Schoenberg Concerto Premiere. So he is the concertmaster of this orchestra, having given world premiere performances of the concertos of Schoenberg and Berg, both of which he did in Minneapolis. Also in Minneapolis, he premiered the Roger Sessions Violin Concerto. Mm. So there's a glimpse of the Mitropoulos repertoire, which also includes the music of the local composer Ernst Krenek, also a serial composer. So Mitropoulos, like Koussevitzky in Boston, like Stokowski in Philadelphia, is making both a distinctive statement in terms of repertoire and a distinctive statement in terms of sound. He is probably my favorite Mahler conductor.
Really?
Mahler is in his wheelhouse, and he's the first man to record Mahler's first symphony. This is with the Minneapolis Orchestra. The year is 1940. And see what you think of the scherzo in this performance.
Okay, let's listen. Thank you.
So that was the first recording ever made of Mahler's First Symphony. The year was 1940. The great Dmitri Mitropoulos, my favorite Mahler conductor, with his amazing but imperfect but amazing Minneapolis Symphony. What did you think of that reading, Bill?
I'm thinking of a couple of things. I'm thinking that Eugene Ormandy preceded Mitropoulos in Minneapolis for about 5 years before.
A far lesser conductor.
But apparently he did so well that he was given the Philadelphia Orchestra.
That was Arthur Judson's doing. Don't make any assumptions.
Actually, I played for Ormandy, and Ormandy was also a better conductor than people allow him now. He was a magnificent orchestral sound person, in my opinion. So what I'm interested in is that Ormandy's sound is very smooth. It's all velour and velvets. And what I hear in Mitropoulos, a lot of edge to it.
For example,
it's interesting the way he starts the scherzo. It's a scherzo for people wearing leather hip boots dancing. It's not a light textured scherzo. And he starts with the cellos and bass playing like boom, boom, boom.
Under tempo.
And then builds into it. It's almost like an old guy getting up to dance with this thing. And it takes him like four or five steps before he finally gets in tempo.
With very heavy accents,
yeah,
as you notice.
And before then, there are spots where the horns are not only muted, but stopped, which gives them a kind of snarl. It's almost demonic. The
it
sound
is
that
demonic.
He gets.
So let's return to the question of textual fidelity. I'm someone who doesn't care about it, but I would say that based on my reading, Mitropoulos comes closest to what Mahler sounded like. And I'll give you an example. The most vivid description I know of Mahler the conductor is Arthur Farwell. This is again from my book, Classical Music in America, describing Mahler conducting Schubert's Ninth Symphony with the New York Philharmonic in 1910. You put your ear to this description and you can hear Schubert as a Mahler composer conducted by Mahler the conductor. He talks about the horn. This is a horn solo at the beginning, so obviously Mahler had that theme played by a single horn, where an exaggerated effect of dramatic contrast was given to the different phrases of the first melody. The second theme of the Allegro, which is the theme in thirds, seemed to be accentuated in a degree unbefitting its character. So also the lyric beauty of the melody in the Andante was somewhat marred by the persistent staccato. However, to many of these little perverse personal elements, the great spirit of the symphony shone forth. Farwell's long description ends, despite the fact that the imp of the perverse pursued Mahler throughout his interpretation of the work. It was a most memorable event. It must be said that his readings are always alive at every point. So what Farwell is describing are hairpin dynamics, the sharpest possible accents, clear textures. These are the hallmarks of Mitropoulos in everything he conducts. And I think it fits Mahler like a glove.
And yet, you say this is Caligari's cabinet.
Well, he came out of Caligari's cabinet. So did Mahler.
Yeah.
I think they're both part of a, let's overgeneralize and
okay,
say,
yeah,
an expressionistic sound world, an expressionistic aesthetic that we associate with Germany in the early 20th century.
Would have been interesting. Mahler died in 1911. Give him another 12 years so he would have lived through the early expressionist painters, say, till 1921 or 22. I wonder how his music might have changed.
Well, that's a big digression. We would have to talk about Mahler and Schoenberg and how they might have influenced one another.
Yeah.
Certainly, Mahler's a great influence on Schoenberg, and Mitropoulos is the greatest of all Schoenberg conductors as well. But we're going to hear him in Schumann. It's the exact same imprint. This is Dr. Caligari plays Schumann. And we know that this performance, this recording of Schumann II, was one that Mitropoulos treasured. He said that this, of all of his Minneapolis recordings, was the one that best represented what he was attempting to do. He obviously had a view of Schumann that rejected conventional wisdom, keying on Schumann's eccentricity, extremes of feeling, his madness. So the year of this recording, and by the way, we're not hearing Mitropoulos in live performance with Minneapolis, which is even more extreme. These are studio performances that are already, you know, bursting the walls of the studio. But this is 1942. Let's listen to the first movement of this unique performance of Schumann's Second Symphony.
Last month, Joe, when you and I talked about what music we would have in this show, you warned me to listen to this recording. I should have taken your warning. I got really busy. I'm hearing it now for the first time. It makes me really jittery. I can't understand the Schumann. I know Schumann's Meshuga. He's already plenty Meshuga. I think I like a more gemütlich Schumann. But I see what you're talking about. It's almost like an expression of Schumann. But if I put it up against my mind, I guess the recordings I love most of all are George Sell with Cleveland. Those four recordings he did of Schumann symphonies are so gorgeous to my ear. But maybe a more legato guy. And all these accents he brings out so strong. Even the opening. Okay, you got a motto theme in the, it's in octaves, in the horn and trumpet. Dum, dum, da, dee, dum. I'm singing it too fast, but dum, dee, oh, dum. Just fifths and roots. And against that, it's in slow 6-4. The strings play quarter notes. They play, And the interesting thing is, Metropolis breaks up every single measure. He makes them stop at the end of the measure before they play the next set of eighth notes. This is so crazy-making for me because I'm used to this legato way of playing it, and I find comedy opening and angst in his performance. Help me out.
Well, this is the sharpest edge we've ever heard in Schumann.
Right.
It's a performance unlike any other. It's a unique vision of Schumann, and he's able to realize it. He's got an orchestra.
Oh, he does.
That's going to do whatever he wants, no matter how unusual, no matter how extreme. It's not a performance for all seasons. It's not a performance for all tastes, but it's a performance.
No doubt about it. I wish there were a way to go back to the 1940s and talk to some of the boys and girls in the band and see what they felt like when they played this piece. I'd really, really be interested in the perspective. For one thing, they would have had hours and hours of rehearsal at Metropolis as they put this together. Plus, they would know him and he would know them. So some of the stuff that I find extreme, maybe they put that into a different context.
I think Metropolis is one thing. Whether it's in Schumann or it's in Mahler or it's in Schoenberg, he is what he is. And you can take it or leave it. But there's nothing like it today. And I think there was nothing else like it even when he was around. As I said about 10 minutes ago before we went the seismic shock from which we're still recuperating of this first movement of the so-called Schumann Second Symphony. As I said about 10 minutes ago, I think it's Mahler that fits him like a glove. This sound, this incredibly intense and angular style of performance, I think it's a Mahler style. And a question that occurs to me is to what extent Mahler himself would have inflicted it on Schumann, because we know he inflicted it on Schubert. That's where we were about 12 minutes ago.
When you're
listening to Arthur Farwell listening, he had the same experience that we just had. When he heard Mahler exercising the imp of the perverse, interpreting Schubert 9, if I were to reread that now, it would be describing your response to Metropolis performing Schumann 2.
Well, I was definitely interested, and at no
point... Alive at every point, he said.
At no point in listening to the recording did I ever convince myself I was listening to Mendelssohn. This is somebody in another world, another psychic world completely.
Metropolis was a big Mendelssohn fan. He has a recording of the Mendelssohn Third Symphony that is absolutely amazing. It's not as extreme as the Schumann II, but it's in the same vein. And I would say it's an important frame of reference for anybody who comes to that symphony to hear what Metropolis does with it.
Metropolis was such a powerful influence on the very young Leonard Bernstein. I think Bernstein was drawn to him emotionally and in every way, but especially musically.
Well, he came to Mahler through Metropolis, I would say. I know that the first thing he ever heard Metropolis conduct was Metropolis's transcription of Beethoven's Opus 131 string quartet with the Boston Symphony, after which he went backstage and introduced himself, and Metropolis gave Bernstein a copy of his own score, and there ensued a very intense, controversial, and erratic interpersonal relationship. Bernstein ultimately famously performed and recorded the Metropolis, Opus 131. Needless to say, I consider Metropolis a greater conductor than Bernstein and a greater Mahler conductor than Bernstein. I would even go so far as to say that the orchestra, I mean now the New York Philharmonic, sounded better under Metropolis than it did under Bernstein. Hmm. Before we leave the topic of Metropolis, let's briefly discuss his fate in New York when he was summoned in 1940. He predicted that it would destroy him. He would become a martyr. Hmm. It's exactly what happened. It did destroy him. He was ultimately terminated. And the agent of his destruction was Arthur Judson, who ran the Philharmonic. And here's a vignette. When Metropolis gave the American premiere of Mahler's Sixth Symphony, a work that had never before been heard on these shores, a work we now consider iconic for the music of the 20th century, it was scheduled for a Sunday afternoon performance, and Judson did not want it broadcast. Hmm. There is a letter in the New York Philharmonic Archives. You can read it. Metropolis says to Judson, "I am begging you on my knees." And Judson said no, and instead the national broadcast audience heard Oscar Levant playing the Gershwin Concerto in F. So there you have a vignette of the relationship between Dmitri Metropolis and Arthur Judson, and the reason that New York never benefited from Metropolis as had Minneapolis.
Hmm. Very interesting.
So we now go to another Mahler-related conductor who, again, is not nearly as well-known as he should be, Artur Bodansky, who was at the Metropolitan Opera from 1915 until he died in 1939 as the chief conductor of the German wing. Bodansky is a very great conductor and a very great Wagner conductor whose name today is barely known. When you hear descriptions of today's Metropolitan Opera Orchestra as a great orchestra, it is not the orchestra that Bodansky conducted. It is a lesser orchestra than what Bodansky had at his disposal. Let's talk about that orchestra. Who were the conductors at the Met before Bodansky? Well, you first had Anton Seidl, who was Wagner's own protege. And after that, you had a guy named Mahler, who we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. And after that, the conductor was Toscanini. So it was Toscanini's orchestra that was inherited in 1915 by Artur Bodansky. And we know that even in 1937, which is the year of the broadcast we're about to listen to, most of those players were Italian, and they sound Italian. This is the most Italianate Wagner orchestra you can imagine. Hmm. It's a powder keg, sharp accents, bright brass, not at all the kind of Wagner orchestra Bodansky was accustomed to in Germany. So he got as much from the orchestra as the orchestra got from him. And his Wagner broadcasts, we can listen to them, are absolutely electric. We're going to listen to the most electrifying performance I know of Brünnhilde's Awakening from the opera Siegfried. The date is January 30, 1937. The Siegfried is Lauritz Melchior, a tenor never replaced. The Brünnhilde is Kirsten Flogstad. But what I'm interested in, at least for the moment, is the conductor and even more the orchestra. You had occasion to hear this in my living room.
We were sitting there about a month ago.
Yeah.
It knocked me out. In fact, I wouldn't go home. I had to hear it again.
Yeah. Do you want to say anything about it before we hear it today?
I think your points are very, very interesting because, I mean, certainly since Jimmy Levine is just leaving the Met now after so long, and a lot of people think that became one of the great opera bands in the whole world, in the history of the world. His is a very, very different sound from what we're about to hear now. And your point that Bodansky's Met Orchestra was Italian in style. It is no longer today.
And we also have to say Bodansky conducted all the time, multiple times per week. The Italian wing had a genius conductor, Ettore Panizza. So this is not today's Met where you get a different conductor every day, every week, every month. Mm-hmm. These were the two guys. There were other conductors, but basically you had the Italian wing under Panizza and there were no jet planes to take him to Buenos Aires and Vienna, and you had the German wing under Bodansky. When Panizza arrived, he said, "This orchestra is as great as any opera orchestra I have ever heard in my life, and this is a man who had conducted in Vienna." Mm. So swallow that. For Mr. Panizza, the Met Orchestra in the 1930s was as great as the Vienna Philharmonic, and it truly is. All you need to do is listen.
So here's Bodansky conducting Melchior and Kirsten Flagstaff. What a cast. Met Opera from 1937. This is a broadcast.
This is a live broadcast. So this is where Siegfried kisses Brünnhilde awake.
Thank you.
So the next time you hear about how great the Metropolitan Orchestra is today compared to yesteryear, that yesteryear goes back to the 1960s and 1970s when the orchestra was not in its peak estate. It does not go back to the 1930s and before. We're hearing a great opera orchestra from the year 1937.
Yeah. Just to bring you folks up to date on what we've been listening to, Wotan, who is the leader of the gods, has placed his beloved daughter Brunhilde into a deep sleep, and he has surrounded her by a moat of fire so that only the bravest soul could cross it and kiss her awake, which has just happened now. Brunhilde is Kirsten Flagstad, and Lawrence Melchior was the Siegfried. Artur Badansky conducting this broadcast from the Met Orchestra from 1937. It's astonishing playing. And one of the things I heard you talking about when we were first listening to this, the way the strings do these beautiful portamenti, these slides that they play. You do that when you sing. And string players used to do that a lot, and now we don't. It's considered sort of old-fashioned and sloppy.
I think we heard a style of string playing that we heard from the New York Philharmonic in 1929, about 45 minutes ago,
in the
prelude to La Traviata by Verdi. We're talking about this incredible ascent in the strings as we approach the moment of the awakening. Never have I heard it so beautiful and articulate as in this broadcast from 1937.